We know that many people have lived on the earth who have succeeded in being able to do that. And much of their words we can now find in what we call Holy Scriptures. One of the reasons that we are reading their words is because they are great men who have lived in the past that have succeeded in piercing this veil, discovering who they are, and as a result, learning much more about the nature of God, which Joseph Smith said was the most important thing we could learn upon this earth. So notice, we could give off a litany of names, such as Adam did this, brother of Jared did this, Moses, Isaiah, Joseph Smith, and others, to show you that it is possible and what will come your way if you can be able to pierce this veil. In other words, that Hosanna shout in your own life. I'm going to share a couple of church history stories to have you start thinking about why that would be important in your life. The first story goes to a man whose name is Heber C. Kimball. Heber C. Kimball, as we'll talk about him, was a member of the original Quorum of the Twelve. This story, however, takes place in Salt Lake City when Heber C. Kimball was serving as a member of the First Presidency of the Church with Brigham Young as president. At that time, he had an estate, and he called it his estate, fairly close to the Salt Lake Temple. He had employed a young man, and one day the young man came to him and said, "President Kimball, I would like you to buy me a new pair of shoes." At which point Heber said to his employee, he said, "I give you an honest wage, and if you would save your own money, you would have the privilege of buying yourself your own pair of shoes." Well, the employee thanked him for the advice, but that evening when he said his prayers, he told the Lord he accepted Heber as a member of the First Presidency, but actually when it came to being an employer, that Heber was the meanest, stingiest employer that he'd ever had. He had asked the man for a pair of shoes, and the man had had the audacity to say no. Well, okay, the next afternoon, as the young employee now sauntered into work, Heber was waiting for him at the gate of his estate, and Heber was holding in his hands a new pair of black boots, at which point the employee said, "Oh, I see, object lesson. You wanted to show me you'd saved your money, therefore you had the privilege to purchase your shoes." At which point Heber said, "Oh no, my friend." He said, "These shoes are for you." The employee was very taken back, and he said, "How could it be? I mean, after all, yesterday you said save your money." And Heber said, "Yes, that was yesterday. But last night you told my God I was the meanest, stingiest employer that you'd ever had." He said, "These shoes are for you with the promise you will never say that to my maker again." Okay, what are we talking about? We're talking about piercing the veil, right? Let me do a couple of others. You realize, teachers, we always drill it in. The next one goes to a man named James E. Talmage. We know James E. Talmage, a great return missionary. As you know which book he wrote, what would you say? Jesus the Christ, you know, and others. Okay. Elder Talmage, what you may not know about Elder Talmage was he was incredibly short. I look forward to meeting Elder Talmage in the next life. I mean, how many men can I go, "Hello"? Okay, so Elder Talmage was so short that he actually carried a little kind of step stool that he stood on so that his head could be seen above the podium. He also had a chair built on the chairs in the tabernacle, so it would be like, here are the rest of the apostles, and could it be anyone seated there in that seat? So perhaps because of height or other reason, Elder Talmage put off marriage, George. as he put off marriage, one of the brethren one day came to him and said, that he thought he should really consider marriage. And James actually told him to mind his own business. But the brother wouldn't back off until James agreed that he would speak with the Lord the next morning in prayer. I now paraphrase his journal. He speaks to the Lord. What's the answer? "Yeah, James, you should marry." At which point, James proceeds to tell the Lord that he is a very busy man and that he has important things to do, and he actually does not have time to date or court. But James proceeds to tell the Lord that he does happen to have this lunch hour available. and that that he would be willing to eat his lunch in the old Pioneer Park, and the Lord would merely point out his walk. Well, sure enough, you know, was it between tuna fish and the apple? I'm not quite sure. But here walks by, you know, drop dead gorgeous, and suddenly James and his wife are married. So what you're picking up, if you pierce the veil, there's an easier way to do it than you're currently doing it. There is a cheaper way to do it. It's just kind of amazing. Well, okay, one last to drill the point. There was a man named Willard Richards, who is in the time period we will talk about. Willard Richards, he was one of the first bachelors placed in the Quorum of the Twelve. I've seen pictures of Willard. I know why that's the case. But nevertheless, at one point, he has a missionary companion in England named Heber C. Kimball. At one point, while they had a different companionship, Heber will write to Willard and say, "I wish you were still with me because I met your wife today at church." Well, for Willard, it takes him about 3 months to get up the courage to go to that area in England. As he arrives there, he's introduced to several people, including a young woman named Jeanette Richards. Willard Richards, his opening line to Jeanette Richards was, "How do you like your last name?" She said, "She's always liked the name Richards," and he said, "How would you like to have it always?" So simple. Okay, piercing the veil. Okay, how can you do that in your behalf? Now, you realize there are Sunday school answers, and actually, they're good, and they do work. You know, prayer, fasting, you know, scripture reading, you know, priesthood leaders. I mean, it's just, you know, it does work. But the one that we had talked about was you were all going to reread Patriarchal Blessings. Does this sound like I know? Okay. So I thought I would talk to you about Patriarchal Blessings and how someone who may never have seen you before has the right to pierce the veil, to literally give you a roadmap so that you can safely return to your Father in heaven, and it will be said, "Well done, thou good and faithful." If we were to look at the definition of patriarch, there are many definitions, including one we'll share this hour called Father Who Blesses. I have known many men that have said that they were the patriarch of their house. I have had an occasion to say to some, you know, call yourself dad, call yourself father, you know, papa, give yourself, you know, any title, but don't call yourself patriarch because actually you are not a blessing to that family. Okay, patriarch then means father who blesses. If we were to take it into church vernacular, you would say a patriarch is a high priest. He's obviously married. He is a very faithful person. But the unusual thing about his calling is that the mantle must fall on the man. Now, you know, I've never had a bishop come up and say, you know, "I saw you walking through the hall. I just knew you'd be good with braids, and I saw the mantle of the young women's camp director fall on you." You know, never, never once. But you'd say, who does the mantle fall on? It falls on the patriarch. Best example goes to Elder Spencer W. Kimball, obviously a grandson of Heber. Spencer, while he was a member of the Quorum of the Twelve, was called to go to a place called Shreveport, Louisiana. While in Shreveport, he was to hold conference, state conference, and in addition, to select the patriarch, to see the man the mantle had fallen on in that particular state. He contacted the state president in advance and asked the state president to gather together men like in a Sunday school room that the state president might assume the mantle had fallen on. When Spencer arrived, he met these wonderful men in the room, but he turned to the state president and he said, "Your patriarch was not present." Well, the state president was surprised. They went out to where the group, you know, people were filing in for conference. Spencer W. Kimball had a great sense of humor, looked out over the group and he said, "I see your patriarch." The state president said, "Which one?" And Spencer said, "The man in the suit." Well, okay, finally Spencer goes, "Okay, follow this." You go two-thirds down, you go in the row, and he's wearing a brown suit, at which point the state president said, you know, he is a wonderful man, But I want to tell you something about him as to why he could never be the patriarch. He indicated that this man had actually been in the Korean War, and there had been this huge landmine explosion, and the man was missing his hands and only had kind of artificial apparatus, you know, attached to his arms. Now, you realize if our church were a church of man, in the Patriarch's Handbook, first line would be, you know, the man must have hands. We got rules here. And, you know, if he doesn't have hands, he can't possibly be the patriarch. But you'd say the man in Shreveport, Louisiana was selected. And what is the criteria? The mantle of the office must fall on the man. Now, when that mantle falls on a man, he then is given the right to do, one, give blessings. And you'd say in those blessings, he is to do two things. The first is he is to tell you the tribe, and the second is your purpose within that tribe. So notice if you are from Ephraim, you would not be given a purpose meant for Naphtali, you know, Dan, Judah, you know, Ephraim, Manasseh. I mean, so tribe drives the blessing. The patriarch then needs to do two things in a blessing. Some blessings are short. Well, of course, all he has to do is tell your tribe, your purpose within the tribe. Others seem to just go on and on and on. Okay, how to best explain it goes a couple of ways. First of all, President Thomas S. Monson, when asked what's the most difficult calling in the church, his comment was, it's patriarch. And when asked why, he said, because a patriarch does not have counselors. In other words, you know, I've always been grateful to have counselors, you know, and young women. When I go, yeah, we're all going roller skating again, it's so much fun. And, you know, my counselor's gone 6 years in a row. You know, it's only fun for you still. And, you know, you really appreciate the counselors that can kind of, you know, give wisdom, knock off the rough edges. For a patriarch, the reason his office is so difficult, he has no one but the Lord to commune with. Got it? In other words, the patriarchs don't all gather in Salt Lake City and say, you know, I've given 30 blessings to Ephraim, you know, 10 to whatever, and, you know, how are you doing? What are you saying? Oh, I like the line. Okay, nothing like that. There is no central gathering. Okay. All right. So the patriarch. The reason that tribe is so important is best explained by looking at an old Jewish synagogue. An old Jewish synagogue always has 12 windows. And underneath the name of each of the windows will be the name of one of the 12 tribes. And sometimes if the synagogue is very well-to-do, they will have stained glass, and other times you see them just kind of painting on the windows, and for Ephraim, you see, you know, it's just spilling off the window. You see all these vines going down, so you can always pick out Ephraim so easy. But what this is to show is that each one of the tribes has a different responsibility, but they all have, as they go out fulfilling these responsibilities, they all have the same blessing at the end if they fulfill the responsibilities, and it's eternal lives or to live as God lives. So with that, as fun as it would be to go through all 12 tribes, and it's really fun because you can see how they all fit together, I'm going to cover the tribe of Ephraim. And the reason for so doing is that Joseph Smith was known as the pure Ephraimite. And if you were to look at the membership brought into the church, Joseph Smith's time, you would say 99% of them were from Ephraim. You get some exceptions, such as Orson Hyde, who's from Judah. But basically, he's gathering Ephraim first. So kind of a stronger than look at Ephraim goes like this. And for all of you that are saying, you know, I never thought tribe was important. I always thought it was important. It said I would graduate from college, you know, I will marry, and or in my case, my children will yet honor me. I mean, you know, it's all relative. You know, I'm just your big sister, you know, moving ahead a little bit quicker towards eternity than hopefully you. But okay, so the tribe. Brigham Young said of the tribe of Ephraim, he had very disparaging things to say about the men of that tribe. He said, the men of the tribe of Ephraim, and he said, I'm actually looking at a congregation of them as he tells us. He says, they are intolerant. They are stubborn. They are unruly. They are warlike. And he just kind of goes off on this. So all of you women that are so excited to marry an Ephraimite male, brace yourself. You know, if you're happy 9 days out of 10, you have a fabulous marriage. Because look who you just married. You've married a leader. And the leader, you know, at some point the leader has to be stubborn because he has confidence in the Lord. He knows who he is, and, you know, he's not going to bear it. So he's stubborn. He's a little bit intolerant because he actually knows where he wants to end up. And warlike, you know, he's willing to fight Armageddon even if it's an only a personal battle. In other words, he wants the spirit of the Lord more than he wants the spirit of Satan. And you'd say, wow, you know, what an incredible leader. You just got in your home. You may not always agree. You wish you wanted the counselor and maybe you could rise up. I don't know. Okay, so did Brigham Young say anything positive about the men of the tribe of Ephraim? And he said that their overarching characteristic was their spirit of adventure. Now, you know, nowhere have I seen that spirit of adventure better than when the mission call comes. And the excitement as everyone gathers around, you open the envelope, and suddenly you're like, oh my gosh, I can't believe it, I'm going to Bogota. And then you go, where the heck is Bogota? Oh, who cares? You know, I'm leaving Utah, I'm leaving Idaho. Wow, the adventure of the whole thing. You know, I'm just getting out of here. I saw that spirit of adventure best in my oldest son. He was excited about his mission, and I fear that he had more fun shopping for P-Day clothes than he did Mr. Max suits that would wear out anybody's lifetime. And you know, the tearful goodbye at the MTC, and, you know, I'm home, I'm still pretty tearful, and about 20 minutes, I get a call from him, and he goes, geez, Mom, he goes, it looks like I'm going to need my scriptures after all. You're like, what? You know, the spirit of adventure was alive and well, and, oh, hey, by the way, I just might preach the gospel. Well, okay. So, with that, if you were to say, what are the responsibilities of Ephraim? Actually, Isaiah tells it best. And Isaiah describes Ephraim and the whole house of Israel. He describes it like a tent. Now, for all of you tenors, it's not your kind of magic tent, and 20 seconds later, you know, you got an amazing dome and, you know, the fire and the hot dogs and cooking. Okay, it's not that kind of tent. It's one of those tents that's like a sheath that fills the whole earth. So according to Isaiah, this house of Israel is just like a dormant sheep that fills the whole earth until the Lord wakes up an Ephraimite. His name was Joseph Smith. We're so excited. We're going to talk about that all semester. So Joseph wakes up, and it's like you see a little head popping up underneath this huge sheep. Joseph translates the stick of Joseph. In other words, the Book of Mormon. He hands it off to his brother, who's our first missionary. Who was that? Samuel Smith, and notice his brother hands it to others, and pretty soon that sheet's starting to move because you get all these people running underneath it. And then finally Joseph goes, we're going to put a stake in the ground to kind of hold that sheet down. And our first stake, anybody name its place? Kirtland, Ohio. Boom, down it goes. And then you start to get other stakes. You get Far West and Adamondiamon and Nauvoo, and eventually, the saints go west to Salt Lake City and then Provo. You know, so all of a sudden, you know, stakes are going everywhere. Well, if you're a real tenor, you know that before you put the pole in the ground, you need to secure the stakes. So you take a long rope and, you know, you put it on the stakes and then you put out, you got kind of a big rock. In the scriptures, it's called the watchtower. Could I do jokes? Oh, sure. Okay. Oh, but you got this tower. Another name is temple. And you put it there, and you'd say, what is the security of the stakes of Zion? And I'd say, it's the temple. You know, as I'm coming kind of down from the Orem Speedway, and I look, and I see our beautiful Provo temple, then I go, oh, yeah, that's my security. That's keeping my stake in the ground. And the reason that it's so secure, there's no veil of forgetfulness in the temple. It's completely rent. Could I give a better class presentation in the temple? Oh, sure, you'd all get it. You go, oh, I know exactly what she said. Do you know what else that means? Okay, so here's then the temple. And once the temples begin to secure all the stakes, then Ephraim will unite with his brother Manasseh. Now, all of you that have any prejudice out there, you got to drop that. Because Ephraim unites with Manasseh. So of all the 12, he goes with Manasseh, and their job is to put in the center pole. They go to a place named Jackson County, Missouri. You know, notice it was settled by those from Kentucky. There, Ephraim and Manasseh will build 24 interconnected temples. Suddenly, with that pole in the ground, you get this amazing tent that will make the sound, according to Isaiah, the sound of silk and robes that will rise up to meet the Savior when he comes to rule and reign. Okay, with that, you've learned something about the responsibilities of Ephraim. Ephraim has leadership. I can't wait till other tribes start to move to Provo and everybody's willing to do what I want to do. Okay, got it? Okay, Ephraim is a leader and you just can't help it. You know, I don't know. You can look at any of your elders' quorums and you can say, I can select this man as president. Here's the 50 other that would do just as well. And you say, Ephraim is a leader. Okay, the next thing that Ephraim is a missionary. Ephraim's like a John the Baptist and Elias. Ephraim's running all underneath this tent saying, prepare ye for someone who is greater than I. So one of the places I ran to under that tent, I was a missionary at Easter Island. And the blessings of the islands of the sea, of their 3,000 population, I never found one person that I hadn't already heard the name of Joseph Smith. And, so I'm at Easter Island. Where'd you guys go? Mexico? Brazil, Russia? Taiwan. Okay. Do you know what a blessed teacher I am? I don't know if you could go anywhere else in the entire world than BYU and have students that weren't just vacationing, but actually living in among the people. I mean, do you realize the wealth of our knowledge that, combined is phenomenal. You know, you don't think the Lord loves you best, think again. Well, okay, so here we are. So Ephraim has missionary work. Ephraim, did you pick it up? They also put the stakes in the ground. Ephraim is to strengthen those stakes of Zion. And you'd say, well, I hate my calling. I'm going, what are you talking about? Your job is to strengthen whoever's coming into the stakes. And then did you see that Ephraim has temple work, genealogy, everything that does with that, you put the temples that dot the earth. Okay, once your patriarch knows something about the tribe, and you can imagine for Ephraim, it would not be unusual if you were to find missionary work, leadership, temples, Okay, once they know something about your tribe, then the question comes to what is your purpose within the tribe? For that, it's now time to study your blessing. There's an amazing difference between reading it and being a student. You know how to be a student. You know how to dissect sentences. You can dissect frogs, animals. Okay, you pull them apart and you put them all back together and suddenly you learn something, right? So there should be nothing really that you study that would be of greater interest to you than who you are and what course is meant for you in life. You ever had somebody that said to you, I have an impression that you should meet so-and-so, and you're like, what are you talking about? If you're not my patriarch, think again. Okay, we're about to study these blessings. We're going to divide not the original document, but we're going to divide it into thirds. Here are my blessings. Here are my commandments. Here are my warnings. And, I'm sure there are other ways to divide it, but actually this one works, and you'd be kind of amazed. Okay, so blessings, they're easy to pick out. You got a patriarchal blessing, not a cursing. So, okay, the blessings, you're looking for words, such as joy, happiness, pleasure, health, strength, courage, faith. You're going to find a lot of your blessings are gifts of the Spirit, such as revelations, dreams, interpretation of dreams, being able to speak in a language and somebody understands you, the right to heal, the right to raise the dead, the right to be healed, and you'll start to look at your blessings. These are the fruits that come by righteous living. In other words, I, the Lord, am what? Bound. When you do what I say, you don't do what I say, those blessings are not yours. You're just like, no, I'm not going to get those blessings. So it's kind of like 1 Nephi 8. It's a tasting of the delicious fruit. What you're going to find is that each blessing is attached to a commandment. And it's much like the scriptures. For example, if I want to run and not be weary, what must I do? Word of wisdom. If I want to know the mysteries of God and not be burned at the last day, what must I do? Pay tithing. Okay, do you see that? And what you're going to find, if you want those blessings, you can lay claim on those blessings and you can pray because your commandments are your strengths. You brought them with you. You already know how to do it. I mean, if you ever had, you know, you go, well, my friend's majoring this, I think I'll major in that. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Go for your strengths. That's your happy life. You know, don't go for your weaknesses. Go what you're already good at. I'm going to do an example from my life. When I looked through my blessing and having done this, I was looking for what was my greatest blessing. And as I looked in, I found that I had been promised great joy. And I'm like, you know, what tops great joy? And I'm like, not much in life. I mean, happiness pales, pleasure's way down the list. And so then I looked at the commandment I needed to keep, and it was genealogy. And I went, oh, no. You know, it's not running. I can't be the big track star. You know, and so I look, and I go, oh, no, it's genealogy. And so I go, you know, I'm going to put that off until, you know, I'm balding, toothless, and, you know, I'm going to have great joy at the very, very end. But then I had a day, and I'm sure you'll all have these days, you know, because we're sitting here on the earth to be tested, when a friend is saying to me, you know, wow, it's such a bad day in your life. Here's either razor blades and not even Prozac will touch this. And so, you know, you look and you go, wow, okay, that really is a bad day. I'm now rereading over my patriarchal blessing. What am I missing the very, very most? And I go, great joy. So I went to wherever LDS books were, and I said, do you have anything on genealogy? And, you know, they had shelves, and I go, I'll take one of each. And throwing them out all over the front room floor and going, okay, what is this? Well, I can now testify that, you know, in the darkest hours, I have had some of my greatest joys. I will be forever grateful for a patriarch that could tell a semi-skinny kid that had no idea, that thought, you know, I'm going to be whatever I was going to be, that my greatest joy would lie in a place that actually, if the patriarch hadn't said it, I wouldn't have found it on my own. And it is so amazing to me. I mean, I could go in a library and, you know, I could just pick the book off the shelves. It's almost like they're falling. And I'm like, that's so amazing. It's a strength. I brought it with me. And guess what? Your commandments are your strengths, and you brought them too. Now, notice the last column is warnings. Warnings are pretty easy to pick out in the blessings. They begin with such words as if. I actually thought my patriarch was stuttering. He was like, if. And I'm going, come on, buddy, just say it. Okay, so they start with if. You know, I admonish you. Oh, you're going to be so sorry. You know, SOS, don't mess up. These are your weaknesses. You know, here's where you have the crack in the armor of God. Here's where your big toe is sticking out. You know, here's going to be, you know, you want to have an unhappy life. Well, you know, you can find it, and you know the way to get it. So what's the happy life? And I can see it time and time again. You know, I've got all the patriarchal blessings of the early saints. I've read them all. I've been followed through all their lives. Who have the happiest lives? It is the people that build their lives on the strengths. And then one by one, you know, they may attack their warnings, but not until they really have the sense of confidence in the Lord. Well, okay, so momentary commitment. For someone that's saying, I'm actually going to do that to my blessing and figure some things out. Okay, good. Thank you. The rest are tentative. Okay.
For you tentative ones, I'm now going to speak of something else. I want to do two other things, because mostly this hour we're talking about why study church history. What I find in studying church history, I learn so much about myself. I can see my weaknesses in Sidney Rigdon and Oliver Cowdery and others. You know, I want to have the strengths of Joseph. We'll see. Okay, one other one. Okay. I'm going to, not like I'm big on trees, but it would appear so this hour. When I was a kid, I learned a song, I'm a Child of God. When I learned it, we used to sing what? Teach me all that I must know. So I'm going to put this up here so I can come across. Okay. When I was a kid, the song sang, teach me all that I must know so that I could live with him someday. As a result, I thought that knowledge was everything to make it to heaven. So I memorized like crazy, and actually the first time, and I wish I could say it was the last time, but the first time I was ever called to kind of command performance, come in and see the bishop, was I had given my young Sunday school teacher too hard a stance because I had been able to show her that what she was teaching was not correct, and I could show her the verse. Well, okay, so the bishop told me his request was, please leave your scriptures at home. So, you know, all right. So, to me, knowledge was everything. I actually thought the Lord would hand me a multiple choice test. He would ask me such things as, here's the Sea of Galilee, here's the variety of fishes existing during the time of Jesus, only two lived till the 20th century, and of those two, which one could have been possibly the fish in which the coin of Peter's would have fit? Okay, I had it down. I was, you know, I just had it nailed. And I was certain that with knowledge, you know, I had it made. So the whole life, you know, get the doctorate, zoom forward, okay. But then all of a sudden, here comes along Spencer W. Kimball that said, Naomi Randall and I wrote this song, I'm a Child of God. She wrote all the words except for one I now change to, teach me all that I must what do. Oh, wow, there's been sad days in my life. That was actually one of them. Because now you realize it was not just enough for me to define faith. Now I needed to do acts of faith. Now it was not just enough to define modesty. Now I had to wear bathing suits. You know, on the beach where everyone could see that only my mother wouldn't be embarrassed to be seeing them. I'm like, what? I'm going to stand out in the crowd. Okay, now it was not just enough to define charity. I had to give my questionable casseroles to those who were ill already. So, okay, as the years came and went, I discovered some things about myself. Not everything that I was doing was magnanimous, such as, what do you mean you can't see me on the 31st for visiting teaching? Okay, so I conclude for our class, I would change the song to teach me all that I must be. Okay, you hear me in the back? A form of the verb to be is I am. Okay. Remember when Moses is up communing with God that he's about to return back to the children of Israel. And he says, you know, who shall I say sent me? And suddenly you see in big letters in Exodus, I am the great I am. I am equals Jehovah. That's the definition. And that's how you get Jehovah of the Old Testament. Notice in my lifetime, there are very few people that have the right to say, are you? And I answer, I am. Exceptions would be, say, the bishop and the state president when I go for a temple recommend so I can get in a place that no longer has the veil of forgetfulness. I can hug everybody and say, I remember you, you, and you. Okay. All right. So, okay. Notice when I go into the bishop, I've always wished that he would say, Susan, can you define tithing? And I go, oh, bishop, 1/10 of my increase. Oh, that's amazing. Let me sign your recommend, and you're going to go now see the state president, and you're off. Or if he were to say, do you do acts of tithing? Oh, bishop, firesides, happy birthday, release society. I think I birthed release society. You know, how many times this year I've babysat.
Oh, that's amazing. It's at least 10% of your time. Yeah, let me sign. You are my ultimate do-gooder. But instead, he asks, are you a full tithe payer? And notice how I answer. I answer, I am, meaning I am Christ-like. You know, health, wealth, poverty, sickness, whatever it is, you can count on me. Now, the more gospel principles you can take from, obviously you have to know it and to do it, to become it, the happier you are. So let me drill it in. Wouldn't it be interesting if the bishop were to say, can you define honesty? And I would then say, oh, Bishop, I've been answering that for so long. You know, I like to kind of use examples. What about George Washington cherry trees? Did it happen? Did it not happen? I mean, what are we talking about here? And or if you were to say, do you do acts of honesty? Oh, the other day I was at the grocery store. I met Macy's. I found a quarter. I gave you, oh, you know, Susan, let me sign on the dotted line. Instead, he asks, are you honest? I then say, I am. I'm Christ-like. Let me do another one. Okay, morality. Susan, can you define morality? Oh, Bishop, I'd really like to talk this year about gonorrhea, syphilis, you know, AIDS. I'm worried about epidemics. I mean, Africa could have come across the ocean. I mean, look what we're facing. You know, what about the marriage issue? Okay, you see that? Do you do moral acts? Well, Bishop, you'd be amazed when I cast up Saturday night. Oh, at your age. Wow, that's pretty fun. You can talk. Okay, but, instead, he asks, are you morally clean? And notice you answer with your Savior, I am. Okay, you're going to love some people in church history. And what you're going to love the most about is that the people that can take the most gospel principles and answer, I am, you will say they have integrity. They are Christ-like. You can count on them. If they tell you something, they actually believe it. They are not wishy-washy. Okay, last but not least. Okay, so notice, I want you thinking. I don't want you just sitting. So, last thought. Okay. When was Joseph Smith born? Okay, he's born in 1805. When does he die?
1841.
Good. 1844. The Lord has, 38 and a half years to be able to communicate with Joseph. How long does he wait? How old is Joseph?
14.
Got it? And then Joseph Smith finds a great friend, Orrin Porter Rockwell. Hey, Joseph, how are you doing? Okay. Suddenly, age 17, are my sins still forgiven me? Well, Joseph, your name's going to be known for good and evil. Well, you know, you need to prepare. You need to keep the commandments. And, oh, wow, we have Martin Harris coming in here, 116 pages. And finally, you'd say, Joseph, where are you at? I finally got it. You know, it's a process. Life is a process. We don't get it all at once. And you'd say, how did his life turn out? Well, it ends with, oh, Lord, my God. And you'd say, Joseph, what did you do? Oh, wow, amazing in his lifetime. Okay, let's put you in. When were you born? 1988. When will you die? Well, it's hard to die now. You know? So, I don't know. Let's give you a 2100. Got it? Okay. Okay. How long did the Lord wait to communicate to you? Do you see parallels? Were you a teenager? Okay. I can remember being a teenager, helping plan events, even saying I'd bring refreshments, knowing I wouldn't be there. And, for young women, and you say, what am I doing? Oh, Follies of Youth, I'm having the best time. Okay, but do you remember the time when suddenly all your friends are going to the movies, and you know what movie they're going to see, and you go, I'm not going to go. Or everybody's out drinking, they're all, and you're like, it used to be me, but hey, it's not me. Okay, my most memorable was, it's almost high school graduation, and I'm at a party, and everybody's drunk out of their mind, and they had concluded at the party that nobody graduates from this inner city school without drinking, and so they'd actually thrown me down on the ground. So women, if that happens,
you got to make sure you can really yell loud, and after that you just cry your head off. And more than that, you make friends with a big guy, right? So suddenly I'm on the ground, you know, they're opening all the beer cans, and suddenly comes in this big football player, and oh, forever grateful to the man, and you know, he's like, he's ready to take on the world, and you know, he's just ready to beat everybody up, and he's pushing them all back, and he's grabbing me up, you know, as if I'm some kind of pencil or something, you know. He goes, now, don't you touch her. And anyway, as soon as I could, you know, I ran home through areas where, you know, you guys wouldn't have run. And, wow, you just got to be fast. You know, that word of wisdom, does it stop, you know, as you get older? I don't think so. You know, running is big. So I make it home, and I say to my parents, tell me about BYU. But, okay, years came and went, and I'm at BYU, and we had some pools. And so suddenly across, distance across the pool, I hear this woman yell out, Susie, is that you? And, you know, nobody calls me that now and gets away with it. She comes over and she goes, hey, you don't really know me. She says, but, you know, I know you. She says, I was a freshman. I was at this amazing party. And do you remember when you were thrown to the ground? And, you know, some things you don't forget. And, you know, I had remembered that. And she said, you know, I was there. She said, you hear what happened at the party afterwards? And I go, no, I have no idea. Actually, I really don't care. And she says, well, you know, we kind of stood around the circle. I mean, why would she run away? You know, it's high school kind of excitement. And somebody said, well, you know, she's a Mormon. And so she said, a few years later, there were these two handsome men that stopped by my house. And they said that they were, you know, these representatives of Jesus Christ, you know, but they also were Mormon. And she said to him, well, do you know Susie? And, you know, he says, no, you know, we don't. She says, you know, I joined the church, I married the temple, here's all my kids. Okay, you just don't know what your stand did. But, you know, as you go through life, you're going to find, well, you know, maybe you're like Joseph, you know, the follies of youth. And at some point, you just kind of figure it out, and you get this amazing sense of integrity. You then look at your personal scripture, your patriarchal blessing. And then finally you go, hey, I really do know who I am. And I know where I stand, and I know which way I face. You know, and I face the eternities. So what do I hope for you? I hope what you've learned is you actually do have a way to pierce the veil, and somebody's done that in your behalf if you're struggling. And as they pierce the veil for you, you can actually know who you are, where you're going, and perhaps you'll even figure out who you're going to take on that life's journey with you. And you'll end up someplace really wonderful. So it will be said, well done, thou good and faithful.